This Sunday Show with Ed Finn.
Sunshine 106.8. Sunshine 106.8.
And you're very welcome to The Sunday Show. We're coming to you this evening from Molly, the Museum of Literature of Ireland, and I'm delighted to be joined by Simon O'Connor, the director. Simon, it's great to be here again.
Thanks a million for having me.
Wonderful. Now, we're here this evening because you're launching a very exciting new exhibition around Brendan Behan's life. Of course, a character that exudes incredible controversy and one of our great tormented souls, I suppose, of Irish literature. But this is a really exciting exhibition that you planned here.
Yeah, it's called The Holy Hour, a Requiem for Brendan Behan. And we've been developing it for quite a few years now, actually, with the writer Patrick McCabe. So some of your listeners will be familiar, obviously, with Pat's books like The Butcher Boy and Breakfast on Pluto and the kind of lovely film adaptations of those. And Pat has been creating this. In a way, it's an audiovisual installation that visitors will come in and sit in, that really tracks Brendan's life from his time as a young boy all the way up through his writing career, up to his death. And in a way, actually, nearly follows him into heaven a little bit at the end. But it really focuses on Behan actually as an artist, you know, and not necessarily entirely as the kind of showman or the person with the really big wild reputation that that we often like to look at.
Yeah, I mean, I remember a very good Irish writer saying to me once that all Irish people would be millionaires if it wasn't for the drink, right? Now, I suppose, in a way, you know, that could apply to a lot of people. But Brendan Behan, I suppose, he would have probably written a lot more and he would have been prolific. But his story, it's really, like, the story is so attractive and yet it has that real appeal, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean he himself says, I think, that, that you know, alcohol is the enemy of the writer, you know. And very early on, I remember having conversations with Pat about this and saying, you know, are there words that we should ban from this exhibition? And one of the words was alcohol, you know, because in a way, I think sometimes in this country, we can be really attracted to the kind of wildness of our artists and that part of their biography. And sometimes that takes your eye off the ball in terms of their work as artists and Behan as a writer, who was an exceptional writer. And fair enough, you know, as you say, he died very young. He died at the age of 41. From alcohol-related causes. But at the same time, behind all of that, he was a great writer who was, like a lot of great writers, continuously struggling with his art form.
I suppose to just look at the origins, really, he was born in 1923 to a working-class family here, a Republican family, and he joined the young IRA, as it were called then,
yeah,
I suppose.
Yeah. So it's, I mean, he's, even in this short life that he has, there's an awful lot of experience packed in, you know, into one. Like, you're right, he joins the IRA. You know, he's as a young man, kind of like barely a young man. He's off to Liverpool on an unofficial bombing campaign. You know, he gets arrested, he gets put in prison. You know, he ends up having experience of the penal system there. Interestingly, one of the things Pat was very interested in making this installation was that moment in his life and, in a way, the care that was taken with him within the British prison system, you know, of this young man who was maybe a little bit out of his depth. But then he comes out and he's, you know, he ends up living in Paris for a period as a writer, you know, like, as, I mean, that's what he is. And he's, you know, he's, aside from the kind of the major plays and the memoir, he has, you know, his beautiful short stories that he's written as well, and some of them during that period. So there's this very rich artistic life going on alongside the politics, which, you know, a lot of the country wasn't very far from at that time when he was growing.
Of course. And I mean, in terms of his education then, I mean, you know, what would it have been like, you know, I suppose, growing up then, working class, he discovered he had a talent for writing. Now, his first book, I mean, his most famous book, I suppose, The Borstal Boy, that took a while to kind of come to fruition, didn't it?
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's like, it's an interesting one in terms of, I mean, it's very, very funny. It's really comic. It's really tragic as well. And it's coming out of all of his experiences. You know, it's a beautiful piece of work.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, his later, The Queer Fellow, of course, right? A play that he wrote, that was really, I suppose, one of his greatest works as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I think that's when he really, that's when people really start noticing Behan too. And then when that gets, you know, I mean, his international career in a way kicks off with that being performed in London in the 1950s. So, and then from that then, you have The Hostage being performed, and then after that, The Hostage goes over to Broadway, and that's in a way nearly marks the last period of his life, but also that moment when he becomes really internationally successful and people really know about him.
At
that point.
And I mean, the other book, I mean, that he wrote as well, then, I mean, it's Confessions of an Irish Rebel. Mm. I was buying it in the shop there a while ago. Very interesting. I mean, Sean O'Casey said it was the best thing in Irish writing. The Spectator said it was the best thing in Irish writing since Sean O'Casey. So, I mean, you know, like incredible accolades and stuff. But he was along the way a good bit. I mean, in terms of personally, he was quite, you know, he'd been quite addicted to alcohol, we know. And there was
I mean, like this is that last period, that post 1960, after he'd gotten to the US. The books from that point on, there's only a handful as well, and Confessions is one of those. Like, they're dictated. These pieces of work. So he could, you know, I mean, he was finding it difficult to sit down and write up to that point. So and although it's obviously really interesting to read it, it's right at the very end there. Something as well to bear in mind too, and I know people do focus on the drinking an awful lot with Behan, but he was diabetic, you know, and you do hear these kind of stories that didn't take a whole lot for him either, you know, to get into a particular situation. But at the same time, it was a cross that he bore, and it did kill him. I mean, he kind of collapsed in a pub before he died.
I suppose just to touch on, I mean, his own life, I suppose, just aside from the writing for a second, he was married to Beatrice, you know, he, like, that was a tempestuous relationship, I suppose.
Yeah.
I mean, for people, for a lot of younger listeners, I suppose, you know, who, like, I would know about being from school and different things, a lot of younger people who wouldn't know a whole lot about him, the way the installation or the exhibition is going to work here is going to be quite interactive as well, is it?
Yeah, so it's really funny, right? Pat had spoken about, Pat was particularly interested in the interior world of Behan, what his kind of interior life must have been like as a writer, and also someone who was brought up in a very, very Catholic country, who would have been, you know, the Catholic liturgy would have been a part of his life, you know, Mass would have been a part of his life. And so Pat actually used the device of the Latin Mass, the Catholic Latin Mass, which is what Behan would have been familiar with.
Yeah.
He uses that as a device to frame the whole installation. So visitors will walk into a room in the museum, like there'll be church pews to sit in, there'll be an altar, and they will sit down and essentially listen.
It's really interesting.
Listen to a Mass, a Requiem Mass for Behan, but Behan is a character in the Mass. Patrick Kavanagh is a character in the Mass. There are all of these different people. Jackie Gleason is a character in the Mass. You know, there's music coming in, but it's not necessarily just religious music. There's music by show bands that he would have been interested in. There's, you know, songs that have themes that are really connected to him. So it's this, in a way, it's this really unusual installation. And, you know, you'll be like any order of service. You'll be invited to stand up and kneel down and sit down and join in some of the prayers. And you might even have to recite a writer's creed, you know, in the middle of it. Or not, you can just sit back and listen and take it all in. But we thought it was a really interesting approach to it, that actually to marry these ideas of spirituality, the interior life of the writer, and then the world outside around him, and then to wrap it all up in a Mass that you go to.
Yeah, that's really tough. I mean, in terms of the Is that something that takes months and months, or is it like years? Or because that sounds like that's huge planning, so creative.
Yeah, I mean, we joke about it all the time, that there's something that we call museum time, which is basically moves very, very slowly. And you know, I mean, it kind of give your listeners a sense of it, that the first kind of detailed conversation I had with Patrick McCabe about this particular piece of work, I was in his sitting room up in Carrick and Shannon, and as Pat was telling me about all of these ideas, the radio in the background was broadcasting Leo Varadkar announcing from Washington that the whole country was about to shut down. So that was back in 2019, you know, or 2020 when we were having this chat. And so COVID put the brakes on it a little bit, but we were really glad that we were able to get it back up and running because it was the centenary of Behan's birth this year on February the 9th, was his 100th birthday. And, his daughter, Blanet, is still alive, and she lives in the UK, and hopefully she'll get over to see the installation as well. There was a lovely event in Liberty Hall recently on his birthday. So I think he's a writer that's really due, I think, a lot of attention and consideration, and probably more so than others, because although people do know him, they know him for his showmanship and his witty one-liners and the fact that he was, that he drank a lot. And, you know, there was this other aspect to him, which was that he was a writer and he was a bloody good one.
This Sunday Show with Ed Finn.
Sunshine 106.8. Sunshine 106.8.
And you're very welcome back to the Sunday Show, coming to you this evening from Molly, the Museum of Literature of Ireland, with my special guest director, Simon O'Connor. I'd love to talk a little bit about Pat McCabe as well, of course, the Butcher Boy, you know, because I mean, I know some people that thought Behan wrote that and Pat liked it. It's funny, it's quite similar sounding to the Borsal Boy, but I mean, some of the phrases you talk about there, you know, when he said he loved weakness in people, and Behan himself, when he said he loved that, it was a real Irish thing, wasn't it? It's really unique, the way that he was a sucker for the weakness in other people or whatever. He had this kind of a thing where he wanted to kind of help people or something.
Yeah, I mean, it's past. We talked about that quite a bit, actually, and Pat talked about this this real sense of tenderness in Behan as well that comes through in the writing, you know, and particularly when you look at those short stories too. Like, I mean, like all of our great writers, he's a brilliant observer of human beings, and he wasn't sitting in an ivory tower doing that. He was out observing people all the time, you know, and he was finding himself all the time. He has such a, as you were saying earlier on, he's such a varied kind of experience of life, even in that, you know, short bunch of 41 years. But I mean, there could be nobody else apart from Pat, I think, to do this, because he's, I think Pat is very open to those ideas of the challenges that writers come up against. Pat's a real lover of voices as well. And he's really tuned to the nuance of conversation and the nuance of character. And obviously as well, he is a huge lover of music and has an incredible musical mind himself. And in this installation, Pat actually voices every character in it himself.
Wow, that's brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is really, really amazing and really entertaining. And half the time you wouldn't know it was him doing it, you know.
Yeah. Now, and there seems to be an incredible fascination as well about being sexuality, right? There's a lot of not written about, you know, oh, he was bisexual, he was this, he was that. Now, that's not something that, I suppose, people say, oh, that wasn't acted out, and then I've heard people chat about it. Is that something that people, like, is touched on in the exhibition as well? Or is that something, is that just speculation, or was that just because he was gregarious and, like, you know, Irish people, a lot of men go to pubs together and stuff. You know, it's hard to get a handle on it, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, look, we could probably have a long conversation about the kind of, you know, the homoeroticism of the Irish pub in the 1940s and 50s. But I think actually that, to me, that would be readings of his work and some of the, and in particular, actually, just some of the sentiments that come through in his work. And I mean, in particular, there's a really wonderful short story, which actually I have here, called After the Wake. And that, you know, really kind of specifically actually plays out a interesting homosexual encounter. And But it's with real tenderness and understanding, you know. So I can, you know, so people will always read these things. But I mean, it's not, you know,
yeah.
There doesn't seem to be any kind of evidence that was the case. But
yeah,
that's neither here nor there in a way.
And what comes across in a lot of his stuff as well, I think, you know, he has this incredible ability for empathy. So, you know, whereas being, I think a lot of writers have that, where they can actually just completely put themselves in other people's positions and imagine all sorts of scenarios, I guess. So that's just a gift of being a very good writer as well.
Yeah, it is. And also someone who had to write copy to deadline as well.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
and he's, you know, like, I mean, he's writing for newspapers and he actually, like, he's written a lot, you know, and it's been published in kind of various compendiums over time, you know. Yeah, and a lot of, like, just very observational pieces, and he's, you know, he's in the scrum with everyone, I think. Which is
now, as some people, I mean, you'd read as well about people saying, you know, that he was a handful, but then other people thought he was quite dangerous because, you know, he could just go off and you wouldn't know. Obviously, he was quite physical as well. Is that sort of handled as well? I mean, because obviously that's something that, you know, it was, as you said, he died at 42. So, you know, it was a short life, really.
Yeah.
A life well lived.
Yeah. I mean, he's, you know, he's a really gregarious character. He knows how to get the media excited. You know, he knows how to give them something that'll turn into a headline. All of these things. He knows how to pose for a photo.
Yeah.
You know, he knows what the snapper is going to want.
Yeah.
And so as a result, we do have this, in a way, this catalogue of images and sound bites from Behan at our disposal. But that, again, that's him playing up to the media. You know, it's him playing up to these people. Like, a huge part of his success in the UK as the Queerfellow was being performed was BBC interviews that he did. And they just couldn't, I mean, people just couldn't believe this fella turning up, like, you know, kind of like half baked and but also kind of amazingly articulate and fearless.
Yeah.
That's another aspect, I think, to be in that's really interesting, is that in these situations he's fearless. And there are some interviews that, you know, your listeners can go and they can find online. A lot of them would be on YouTube and things, where in a way actually you sometimes get a sense that he's answering the interviewers as if the interviewers aren't there. He's being that personal and that honest with himself in the context, which is kind of, and it can be, and some of those instances are really quite sad, you know.
Yeah.
Like, there's one where he talks about where I think it was a Granada TV interview, and you know, he's asked something along the lines of what, you know, is there anything that he would have liked to do, and he said, I would have liked to be a writer. Do you know, and when you think about that, I mean, how devastating it is to hear someone say
that. Shuts the interview down.
Yeah. But then the guy cuts and says, oh, we'll do that one again, you know, because they left in the footage. And because they want, you know, they want the character.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. That was something that he had. I was sort of ahead of his time. That shock factor. Think of it, if he was around today, like the social media thing, he'd probably have 2 million followers.
Yeah,
two million
followers, and he'd be asking Elon Musk to let him back onto Twitter. But you know, there's something that's I think is really attractive for us about artists like that who are really fearless, you know, and in a way act as if they have nothing to lose, and they'll speak truth to power. And, you know, he'll walk on to the set of the BBC and he'll give an interview and he'll be exactly who he is. And he won't tone it down, you know. And that's exciting, you know, and especially for us as a small island, you know, we love it when our artists go out and do that and do things that we wouldn't necessarily have the neck to do ourselves, you know. Praise them for it.
Yeah, well, of course, and that's what's great. We chatted last year about Ulysses, of course, which was, you know, a big year for you as well.
Yeah.
That's something that you're really doing well here, though, isn't it? You're taking these amazing sort of Irish literary figures and you're really showcasing them at their best to a new, completely kind of new audience in a sort of a contemporary way.
Yeah, because I think, you know, and we all grow up in this country hearing these names, you know, like you hear the name of Joyce, or you hear the name of Becca, or you hear the name of Behan, and all these fellas as well, you know, which is another kind of aspect to it. And they have these massive reputations, and sometimes people can just forget about the fact that they were great artists who, you know, exerted a really huge influence all over the world and on other artists, and you know, encouraged other people to create work. So through their own. So I think that's what we try to do here is to try and just look at them in a slightly different way. Do you know, like, I mean, we could have done an exhibition that was all about Brendan Behan with, you know, his passport, his handkerchief, his typewriter, an empty pint glass, blah, blah, blah. And he was born there. This is what he did. And then he died. But, you know, we're more interested, I think, in how do we get into the spirit of these people? How do we maybe transmit something about who they were rather than the story of what they were?
Yeah. And I think, you know, a church scenario, a church scene is certainly going to get, if that can capture the imagination.
Yeah, I really didn't think it was going to turn out like that, but that's where we are.
Holiness personified.
Yeah.
That's brilliant. I mean, do you think overall, I mean, if you were to say yourself in a nutshell, I mean, his philosophy overall being, I mean, was it a kind of feckless, he didn't care, a lot of people think he was high, I mean, obviously, you know, his style and his writing, highly intelligent, but his philosophy and his outlook on life was, he wasn't a planner in the head. He kind of took day every day as it came in a way as well, didn't he, sort of thing?
He's really kind of journeying through life and just allowing the current of it, I think, to bring
keeping the levels up
wherever it's going to go. But I do get a sense, and I'm not a kind of an academic expert by any stretch on being, but I do get a sense that there's an ongoing battle that he's always having throughout his life, and that battle is it's between say his physical inclinations and his desire to communicate and be a writer. Wrapped up into that is the complexity of Irish history, the brutality of the kind of the experiences that he's had as a young man in prison, but also then the tenderness and the kind of awareness that's brought him to. And then I think there's a really good, solid, fundamental streak of anti-establishmentism in it. That's a real part of our history as well, as both a colonial and then eventually a post-colonial country.
That rebel kind of thing.
And you know, that's an admirable thing. You know, it's a great thing. That's what art is about. Like, art is about, you know, not taking the world as it is for granted. You know, it's about imagining something else. I mean, that's what all of our artists are doing all the time. They're imagining other worlds, other ways of being. And trying to tell the truth. And I think that's something that he's at all the time.
This Sunday Show with Ed Finn.
Sunshine 106.8. Sunshine 106.8.
And you're very welcome back to The Sunday Show, coming to you this evening from Molly, the Museum of Literature of Ireland, with my special guest, director Simon O'Connor.
Now, just moving on a little bit about all the stuff you're doing here. Yeah. Now, Peg, of course, somebody that tormented a lot of us in school when we were growing up. You took Peg here, and I know the exhibition is over now, but you had a great success here with a really beautiful exhibition about Peg Sayers. Yeah. And that was, again, for those of us who kind of suffered through compulsive Irish in school and coming back to it now, I suppose, getting to learn Irish again is a joy when you're not forced to do it.
Yeah.
But that was a really successful exhibition here, wasn't it?
Yeah, we were really delighted. We collaborated with the National Folklore Collection, which is based out in UCD. And that is the repository of so many amazing artifacts and manuscripts and documents relating to the Department of Folklore, the Irish Folklore Commission. And it's all out in UCD. And we had just always felt that Peg Sayers, I mean, as you kind of hinted at there, by virtue of the way she was taught compulsory in the secondary school syllabus up until the mid-90s, that, you know, people seemed to have this fear or dislike of her. And it was nearly like across the board. You know, I mean, as you said, you say the word Peg to some people and they kind of like, they twitch and shake, you know. But like the reality of who Peg Sayers was and what she was doing on the Great Blasket, both for her island community in terms of attracting people to it, and then on an international stage, as what was described to us as a major moment in international folklore, the discovery of this old woman sitting in her island community with this huge encyclopedic store of oral stories that she was telling in her own dialect of her own language as that community was disappearing as well. Like that was just something that had barely existed. So there were folklorists coming from Germany, from Scandinavia, from the UK, coming over, learning Irish, learning how to transcribe old Irish phonetically, and recording all of these stories. And then that work has continued up until this day. And there wasn't just the story of Peg that we wanted to look at. We wanted to look at the story of those folklorists as well, and that collecting, because it's kind of tied into the new nation too, and the establishment of the Irish state, and this sense of trying to burrow around in a rural identity and kind of pull that out and present it to the people as something that's kind of nearly sacrosanct. So there was lots to talk about in it. And also to showcase some of the material from the National Folklore Collection, which is just the most amazing resource. So we had great fun doing that.
Great. And will that, I mean, how does it work? Will that now move on, or, you know, will that, what are the plans for it?
Yeah. So that exhibition is closed now. It ran for 6 months, but it will be digitized, and we'll be putting it all online as well. So that's something that we eventually do with all the exhibitions in the museum. They go online and they're there in perpetuity, so people can look at them. But you know, it's interesting about Peg, because what people studied was a slightly abridged memoir of hers. But they weren't the only stories that she had. I mean, she had lots of folklore. There were ghost stories, supernatural tales, stories that had actually, that we would all recognize from the Brothers Grimm and European tales.
I was completely surprised by that when I came to see the exhibition. I mean, that was really like, wow, I never knew any of that.
Yeah, and things that drifted. I mean, the way stories move, the way music moves, you know, it moves through people, and people travel and things get brought from country to country. So you have, like, you know, like Peg has this kind of wonderful version of Cinderella that she's, you know, turned into a local folktale. There was a fantastic documentary there made a couple of years back on her, and she was referred to as the Netflix of her generation, which I thought was a great description, because
what's the Irish for Netflix? Yeah.
Netflix. But she would, but you know, people would come to her cottage on a, you know, on a weekend night to listen to another installment of some of these kind of epic tales that she had as well. So, I mean, in any other world, I always thought there'd be a statue to Peg in the middle of the capital city here on O'Connell Street. Anyway.
It's not too late. I mean, there's plenty of time. Yeah. It must give you a great pleasure to be able to expose sides of people like that. You know, as I said, like I was so surprised in a great way. But that's such a nice part of what you do here, isn't it?
Yeah, it's, to be honest, it's really enjoyable, and I feel very lucky to be able to do it, because there's also a little bit of a sense of mischief in it as well. You know, I mean, to me, I always thought,
set the apple cart,
well, if that many people dislike Peg, then we have to do something. There has to be more to that. You know, 5 million people can't be right.
Yeah.
So I think as well, we try to have, and that's, in a way, it's coming nearly from Joyce himself, who's so kind of influential on how the museum was developed and created, that we should have that sense of mischief and that sense of exploration going on all the time, and not just settling for the kind of predictable way of going about things in the museum, but we should always try and find new, unusual, imaginative ways to tell these stories.
Absolutely. It's funny, when I went to Joyce's grave in Zurich, the Fluntern Cemetery, and which is absolutely beautiful.
I've never been.
It's amazing. And I went to Switzerland on a school tour when I was 14, and kind of kept going back. I fell in love with the place. But Zurich, of course, has a whole Joyce Centre and things. But very funny, if you die within a 30-kilometre radius of the cemetery, you're buried for free, right? So that was something very interesting and very Irish about that.
So let's just time. Anyway,
that's trivia.
Really challenging but night out to be within 30 kilometres.
It's interesting, but for anybody who wants, I just wanted to mention that it's a great place to go up on the hill there by the FIFA headquarters, actually. Yeah. But it's a really beautiful cemetery, and and it made me feel very proud when I went there and saw his grave. But that's just for people that might like to visit it. Yeah. Moving on just finally to a living literary figure, Enda O'Brien, which you're doing something very exciting about as well.
Yeah, so we have a wonderful teen writers bursary here in the museum called the Edna O'Brien Bursary, which is named for Edna, and she kind of very graciously allowed us to use her name in it. And we had set it up really, you know, part of our work in the museum isn't just looking at these writers from the past, but it's also, you know, working with living writers like, say, Pat on the Behan exhibition to do that. but then also encouraging the next generation of writers as they come up, and making it possible for people from all over the country actually to come to the museum and explore their own creative potential. So we have this bursary, and it's an incredible program. It's a 1 week long immersive bursary in the museum. The students who come, there are 15 places on it. It's quite difficult to get a place. It's a very competitive process. 15 to 17 year olds. So we try and get them just before the leaving cert gets its claws into them and destroy their creativity. We want to give them this one last glimpse of what might be possible after the leaving cert, be it through writing as an occupation or through, you know, academic study of literature, or even just working in the literary industry. So these 15 young writers come and they go and they live in UCD for the week in the UCD residences, and they're bussed in and out of the museum, and they get to meet, you know, amazing writers. They work with a writer mentor for the whole week on a creative project that then gets published at the end of it. And we make a short film with them, and they get to meet publishers and agents and academics, and just to get this whole sense of nearly like a peek behind the curtain into the whole literary world. And it's mind blowing for them, you know, and we get an amazingly diverse range of young people come in, you know, from all over the country and from all walks of life as well. You know, it's really interesting, just the process of application, because it's all blind. So we just always end up with this incredible mix every year. And I think one of the most important things that we do in the museum, actually.
That's brilliant. Yeah, I love the sound of that. I mean, that's obviously, I'd love something for that for more mature students. It'd be great.
They'll get there eventually.
Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah. And you can live out in UCD yet.
Yeah, I love it. Trinity would be better. It'd be handy for me. Simon, just in terms of the permanent exhibition, I suppose when people come in, you know, there's a lovely membership you have here. Yeah. People can join. I love my little Molly card because it gets you into the gardens. You get 10% off little books and things.
Yeah.
Just in terms of what people come in, I mean, the whole history, the Museum of Literature of Ireland, I mean, what you get when people come in on the tour itself, just to finish off.
Yeah, so for any of your listeners who haven't been before, the museum is on the south side of St. Stephen's Green. So that's the side nearest Harcourt Street, because as Dubliners, we don't know what the north and south.
Besides Staunton's Hotel.
Besides Staunton's Hotel.
Give them a plug.
Besides University Church. And it's across three beautiful buildings, two Georgian and one Victorian building. And those buildings are the original home of UCD. So the first experience of coming into the museum is actually a beautiful architectural experience, and all of this gorgeous plaster work from the 1760s and the 1730s. But then you go through and there's all of these, you know, wonderful exhibitions, and some of them are pretty, I suppose, typical in terms of we've got old things in glass cases that are very valuable and rare. But there's also really interesting digital interactive exhibitions, like, you know, installations that we've worked on with artists. And a lot of this is always changing all the time. And then we have beautiful gardens that we've landscaped out the back that open up into the Ivy Gardens as well. And this is where you really get a sense of the museum as a kind of oasis right in the middle of the capital city. Most of the people who come, they're just like amazed that this even exists in Dublin. They didn't know it was there. We have a gorgeous cafe restaurant downstairs as well called The Commons, which is run by Dominie and Peaches Kemp.
Yes, I've had the best carrot cake in Dublin.
There, you've heard it here. The best carrot cake. It's fantastic. We're very, very lucky to have them downstairs, and a gorgeous museum gift shop. You always have to have a lovely gift shop, and ours is, I think, particularly lovely. So there's just people come and they spend hours and hours here, and you can become a member. So if you fancy coming back again and again, you can bring friends who might be visiting you. You can get your discounts in the shop and the cafe. And then there's lots of events that are happening all the time. We open late actually, and for free on the first Friday of every month until 9 p.m. And that's become a really successful time to visit the exhibition. It's really, you know, we have hundreds of people coming through, like a little mini culture night on the first
Fantastic.
Friday of every month.
Yeah, that's brilliant. So just in terms of the exhibition there, when is it opening up? The 10th, is it?
So The Holy Hour, A Requiem for Brendan Behan by Patrick McKay.
Brilliant.
It's a lovely time.
I'll have to go to confession before I come in.
But, you know, we probably should have got a confession booth in it, although
it's not too late.
Be a queue down
it's
the
not
road.
Too late. Yeah, be busy. You'll never get the queues.
That's going to open on, it'll be up to the public on March the 10th.
Okay.
And it'll run until the end of October this year.
Okay, brilliant. Listen, Simon O'Connor, it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Pleasure.
Always a pleasure to be here in Molly. Thanks a million.
Thanks a million. Take care.